When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Before there was IMDb.com, there was Zach and Dustin.
You know those guys who think they know everything about a movie without having to go on the internet to look it up? Well, that's us, but maybe only for the years 1981 through mid-1989.
No, I'd say late 1978 through early 1992. Either way, we know movies. And even more specifically, we know soundtracks from those movies.
Yeah, this is $2 Late Fee with Zach and Dustin.
This is the podcast where we pick a movie and soundtrack from our youth that we loved and see if it still holds up today.
All in the spirit of positivity and togetherness. Thanks for listening. On to the show.
Well, hot damn. It's time for another episode. How you doing?
Doing fantastic. I can't wait to have this trip down memory lane with our guest.
It's so interesting how these little trips to memory lane are like all we have right now in the world, you know? These, we just cling to the joyful nostalgic place where there is no fear and awfulness. It's just good fun.
It's not just good fun, it's good fun that ends up making you go, "Oh, I didn't know that."
That's true. I think today's interview revealed so much to me about some of my favorite movies. Today we've got Ari Gross on the show, and what an illuminating interview this was, because the stories that he told were so kind of above and beyond with the behind the scenes that I, you know, I mean, obviously that's what we always aspire to, get those little tidbits of information about the movies we love, whether it's, you know, in this case, it's Just One of the Guys, Exterminator 2, you know, all of these films that are like so almost sacred to us. We got some just great stories.
Oftentimes when we interview someone on our show, we get an informative background, where they're from, you know, how they grew up, where they went to school, yada yada yada, all that good stuff. And Ari, from the get-go, just jumps right into one story after another about his experiences in the films he's made. Yeah, I didn't expect to bring up Exterminator 2, but we did, and what came out of it was hilarious, in my opinion. A lot of fun and depth as well. Such an entertaining interview, positive experience, great guy to talk to, just a real honor. And I think by the end of this thing, we both were like, whoa.
Yeah.
There's much more to talk about, which we'll hopefully do at a later date.
Yeah, I felt like I grew as a person, and I'm better for it. So, yeah, I guess we won't. No more dilly-dallying. Let's just get right to it. Here is our interview with the great Ari Gross.
Sit back and enjoy.
Ari Gross, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
It's really exciting to have you on the show, and Zach and I are very big fans of your work.
Huge.
Huge. We won't be shy. Huge. Yeah.
It's very, very kind of you.
It's just, I mean, it's obviously, it's not really an exciting time in the world at large right now for many people?
Well, you know, it depends on where you are, I guess.
True.
But in our little world, it's always nice. And yeah, we appreciate you jumping in with us. How are things? How are you doing? We were just discussing that it's been just a very heavy week for everybody.
Yeah, it has. You know, there's just randomly, my iTunes yesterday played a Tedeschi Trucks band track called The Storm. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
I love that band.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And the storm starts with a flood, and then it talks about everything burning, and I just thought, well, this kind of, you know, sums up late August 2020.
Unfortunately,
So I'm fine. Like, you know, I'm in California, and it's I'm not in an area that's on fire at the moment. There's no hurricane.
Always good.
And
be there.
And nobody in the house needs a ventilator. So, you know, that's so good. Far, so good.
Truly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Well
but
said.
It is crazy time, huh?
It is a crazy time. I just feel like when we think it can't get any crazier, it gets crazier.
Yeah. Right. Kind of just waiting for the reign of bullfrogs to start.
Seriously.
That's it. Like, what's the next plague? You know, earlier this week, it was like, oh, an asteroid's coming. I'm like, that makes sense. You know, it's just, 2020, Merry Christmas.
Why wait?
Then there's going to be a robot that blasts from the future into the past and starts looking for Sarah Connor, and then we've got a whole other movie on our hands.
Yeah.
There we are. That's right.
So good. Glad you're doing well. Obviously, You are a very eclectic actor. You've done a lot of different things, and you are one of those actors who I feel like everybody knows visually, but doesn't necessarily know your name. And you know, but there's nobody like I could show your picture to anyone, and they're like, "Oh, of course, of course."
I love that guy.
That guy. Thank you, brother.
That guy. There's the guy we love, and everyone can always. Point to like.
I love everyone who says that. By the way, so
absolutely. But I feel like everyone can kind of point to like a performance of yours in which, you know, something resonated. And like, I think for us, probably at least for me personally, Zach, you can chime in on this. Just One of the Guys was, I think, our first exposure to your work, and that's a film we've covered so many times on this show. We had Joyce Heiser Robinson, who played Terry on the show. That was a very special movie for her. I'd love to know what your experience was like.
I hadn't really exposed myself much before Just One of the Guys. I had done a couple of things, but.
Exterminator 2.
Exterminator 2, of course.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Of
you
course.
Really, you
we don't
had
start
to.
In the
just
beginning.
Because you we know never, it, you don't have to say it.
We never start in the beginning, also. Like,
Okay.
Wait, I just have to say for clarification, you said ahead of time, you had no problem talking about anything. So we bring up Exterminator 2.
I'll talk about it. I'll talk about it. I didn't say I was going to be happy about it, but I will talk about it.
Just kidding.
I'll tell you this about Exterminator 2. I read for the thing and then I weirdly got hired for some reason. And what I was doing were the like 2 weeks of reshoots for the sequel to Exterminator. And I was part of a part of Mario Van Peebles' gang.
Yeah.
And I believe my name was Turbo. And then when we were in our hideout, and it was time for me to say words, the director kept coming up to me and saying, like, do it more like at the audition. Like, you're not doing it like at the audition. And
I love that.
Thing. Oh, I'm not really sure exactly what that was. And there was like take after take, and the other guys in the gang were suddenly like, come on, man. I'm like, what the fuck? And she's like, get it together. And so I honestly, I have no idea what I'm not doing. And then finally I said, when you audition, you had like this like really kind of nasal thing. And I was like, oh, I had a terrible cold during
audition. Yep.
Oh my God, it's hilarious.
Like, I don't know. Can I stick some cotton in my nose? Maybe yeah, that'll right. work. Yeah. So, I had a fabulous time on that.
Fucking bro.
This watch ain't nothing to brag about. It's phony cocktail. Let's go.
You see the look on her face when you put it through her? Damn, that was good.
Yeah. I like when the faces go crazy like that. Like they think the world's gone psycho and there's no way out.
But that's it. What you're speaking of is a very interesting challenge for an actor, because there are times when you're not quite, feeling well. And, as voice actors, it's like, we know like any time we audition for something that we can't replicate later,
yeah.
of course we're going to book it, right? Like of course, and they're going to want that. Like, I just had morning voice that day and the only way I could replicate that is if we shot it at 4 a.m. maybe, or recorded it at 4 a.m. So,
I just had a root canal.
You're asking me when I had cotton in my mouth.
So is that something where from that experience you then maybe had some second thoughts if you ever weren't feeling?
No, I just put it out of my mind and marked it up to another like strange difficulty of the business.
Yep.
But no, I didn't do the like note to self always. record yourself before you audition. So if they like it, you know what you were doing.
Right.
Well, I do. I will say, going back to what Dustin was saying about Just One of the Guys, your role in that film as Willie, to me, I feel like one of the reasons why I love that movie so much is because each character is so well fleshed out, even the small ones. Like where you go, I want to know more about this guy. I want to know about this backstory. What's your interest in science fiction? Were you a Trekkie or were you more of a Star Wars guy? Like, I mean.
Whoa. What are you talking about?
Beep, pop, pop. Yeah, no, yeah. You're so great in that.
So have you guys talked to Robert Field Steele yet by any chance?
No.
Phil? All right. So there is kind of a story to Willie and Phil in this. First of all, wonderful actor and playwright now and teacher. I think he's teaching in the University of Georgia. Is Robert Field Steele, who played my counterpart in Just One of the Guys. And we'd actually been kind of involved with that project at the very early stages, where it was being workshopped in a playwriting and screenwriting workshop that the actress Dee Dee Cohn ran in Hollywood.
Got it. Cool.
And it was the kind of thing where you would show up as an actor, and writers would have material that they wanted the other writers in the group to hear and give them feedback. And so I made a point of going to this thing. I had other friends who were actors who were involved in it, and it seemed like a good way to kind of get a little experience. And really, when you're starting out, particularly, you look for like every opportunity you can to sure. exercise.
Yeah, totally.
And So Robert and I started reading these Willie and Phil characters in this high school comedy that was, sort of based on Twelfth Night, and we eventually, once the movie was getting made, we were offered the parts, which was fantastic. That Lisa was able to Lisa Gottlieb, the director writer, was able to do that for us.
That's great.
And so they were in pre-production. We already knew that we had the jobs and that we were going to go to location in Scottsdale, Arizona to shoot it. And we got a phone call from Lisa because we were Trekkies, like down the line.
Trekkies. Oh wow, legit.
Okay.
And they said, okay, so it's a Columbia movie, and Paramount, I guess, has a Star Trek movie coming out, and they're not giving Columbia any rights to use any Star Trek references. So you guys have to be something other than Trekkies. And so think about what you might want to do, and we're going to sort of kick it around. And then shortly after that, they sent us some pages, and we were horror movie fans.
Oh, okay.
Mm. But kind of generic.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the bits in the lunchroom were like, there'd be a, you know, one of us would find a human eye in our spaghetti here. You know,
like Chainsaw and Dave in summer school.
Right.
Yeah, right. So it just did not really feel, it didn't feel particularly compelling.
No.
And Robert and I, we'd been trying to learn, like, Klingon when we were doing when we were going to be Trekkies, but then we just pitched this idea that we weren't, you know, science fiction fans or Trekkies. We were from another galaxy.
Yeah.
And yeah. We were here to study human behavior.
Yeah. That's awesome.
and we had a language that we spoke.
Yeah.
And
it's a great language.
Everybody was so overwhelmed making the movie that they just kind of went, fine. Just okay. That's so funny. Will you have something? So you're in a scene in the gym, just like, can you write it out? And we'd sort of write a couple of lines of dialogue and go, all right, we don't have to linger on you guys. That'll be fine. And then when we got there, we'd work all the time on like what the scene would be and what the conflict would be and
what
we were trying to resolve. We took it very, like, super, super seriously.
I'll take Willie if you take Phil.
Okay, come on, guys. Okay.
What an opportunity. Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Wow.
We actually, Lisa filmed us singing for the final credits, but they didn't use it because there was, again, a rights problem. We sang the song "Love Is a Many Splendored Thing," but in our language.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, amazing. In our Fraknishnir
language.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Wait, did that wind up on the cutting room floor? Like, is that something we might
see? It wound up on the cutting room floor.
Oh, I mean, because the Blu-ray edition came out fairly recently, and I know it was very popular, and it has a commentary track on it, but that's about it. And when we were talking to Joyce, she's like, I would love to see a real, you know, special edition of this film come out, and
deleted scenes, and for sure,
that would be incredible.
Or you can just recreate that with us, you know, down the road when we see you in person.
Sure, let's find you Robert right now.
Yeah,
awesome. There's no rights problems on our show.
Nope,
no copyright. We'll do whatever.
Oh, that's great.
I will tell you, we were constantly together. And as a result, we shot the shooting schedule, encompassed, Thanksgiving, of that year. I think it was 84 that we did it. And Robert left on a Wednesday morning, to go back to LA to be with his family for Thanksgiving. And somebody from the production office was, you know, going to drive him to the airport. And I got a call at about 6:30 in the morning, and I had the day off. It was the day before Thanksgiving, but I was staying, and they said, Hi, Ari, sorry to wake you. Is Robert there? And I said, what do you mean? They go, well, you know, the van's ready to take him, pick him up yet.
Oh, no.
And I said, why? Why would Robert be here? And they're like, oh, I just, well, we tried his room and there was no answer. And, you guys are always together. Anyways.
That's hilarious.
Okay. I do have I have a favorite thing about just one of the guys. If you can bear to hear any more about it.
Of course.
Oh, please.
Please.
Welcome it.
The actor who played the coach is John Apicella. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful actor. And, and as Robert and myself had been working on this thing before we, before it was picked up or greenlit, you know, John developed that role, and we'd all work together on stage in LA, and we flew in to Phoenix together. And, John was a couple of years older, had lived in Scottsdale, and there's something of a kind of guru about him. And he was reading Mark Halperin's Winter's Tale. And as we were flying in, he was saying, you know, that according to this book, what you do when you enter a new city has everything to do with the direction from which you've entered it. So theoretically, we're coming in from the west, but the plane is banking, so we're really coming in from the east. And if you enter a city from the east, according to this book, your mission in the city is to engender and foster feelings of love in that city.
Wow!
And we're like, okay, that's good to know. And we showed up. We worked for a few days. We shot the big scene at the prom, and all the pretty girls in the movie, women, all the lead women in the movie, almost without exception, but I'm sure there were kind of hanging out with the band that played.
Yes,
yeah, and that band. And Robert and John and Stu Chernow and I, our honey wagons were like on a totally other side of the water park where we were shooting, and we even put up a sign that said "Character Actors Ghetto," because we weren't with any of the like beautiful, you know, young leading actors.
You weren't with Brock and Davis.
No, we were not. And so. As things worked out at the end of that sequence where we were night shooting, and John had a car that he had borrowed from a friend who still lived in the area, we invited Robert and John and I, three of the female actors in the movie,
as you should,
to have breakfast with us at Denny's.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
And we thought, yeah, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
This is going to be great. And they spent the entire time talking about which of the band members were like the hottest.
Oh, yes.
And John said, isn't this amazing that like we worked on this thing from a, you know, workshop in a basement in Hollywood, and it becomes a big Columbia movie, and we're out, did night shoots and with these beautiful actresses, and they all turn out to be yahoos. And so they were a little offended, and we all went back to the hotel, dropped them off, and John and Robert and I would go on these long drives. John would drive us around Scottsdale and show us the sort of stations of his youth. Amazing. You know, he'd say, "This is right up the road. There is that's the house where my girlfriend and I had set." Oh, wow, it's a 7-Eleven. Wow, that's a bummer. It's a 7-Eleven. And then, but here, I'll show you this other thing. And I'm going to show you the place, like, the first time I got high. Like, I'd smoked weed a couple of times before, but the first time I really got high, it's in, oh my God, that's a 7-Eleven. So we started going to these 7-Elevens, and on that particular night, they were selling flowers at the 7-Eleven. Not all of them do. Some in Arizona in the mid-80s were selling flowers. So we decided we would get 3 bouquets of flowers and give them to each of these actresses as a sort of apology for insulting them. Earlier that morning.
Very classy.
Yeah. And yeah, I thought so. And we didn't want to wake them, so we just left them on their in front of their hotel rooms.
Oh no.
And the next day we're all in the van going to the location, and you know, one of the actresses is like, "You got flowers too?" There's the weirdest. I think, you know what? It's the guys from the band. Yeah. They gave us the flowers.
Oh!
So,
Brock and Jess.
We
had to learn the
decided
hard
not to say anything, and we incorporated it into our mission of spreading love as our true mission while we were there. So, for the rest of the shoot, secretly, like commandos, we'd get flowers every night, and we made sure to leave flowers for a few people until we got everybody in the crew.
Oh my God.
So some people thought it was great. Some people were scared and thought there should be security looking out for whoever was doing this. And then at the end of the schedule, we went to a restaurant that had like a kind of Western theme, and you could dress up in Western garb and put on holsters and hold rifles and, you know, cowboy hats. And got an old-time photograph taken as the bouquet bandits.
Oh, the bouquet bandits.
Yeah, with like flowers coming out of our holsters and out of the end of the rifles and
sticking out
of our waistcoats and stuff. And we just made a photograph and left it at the production office for everybody. And went on our way. And I recently found my copy of the photograph.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So if you guys give me an email address later on, I'll send you a copy.
I mean,
please do.
Have mine. Send away.
I think it was one of the best times I've ever had on a shoot, because there was this like strong secondary like preoccupation. We were on a mission, and really shooting the thing was a little secondary.
Yeah. It sounds like had this experience of like, I mean, but Dustin and I both talk about, you know, pining for girls back in the day. But that feeling of being like, we were both speaking personally, it was a little bit of an outsider, and really always was attracted to like the really popular girl, and would try to go out of my way. But then I was always like, oh, you did that so nicely for me. I'm going to thank you so much. I don't want to date you, but I'll take whatever you want to give me, kind of thing, you know? So that story is gold.
I just love that that's just born out of, like, you know, you landing the plane with this idea from the book of, we're coming in from the East. This is the goal. And obviously touring every single 7-Eleven from his childhood is unbelievably funny.
I just recently watched a great documentary about Brian Eno.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hold on a second? Sorry.
Yeah.
My daughter's on break from school. Sophia, I'm doing a podcast right now. Can we talk about it in a little bit? I think she's out in the garden, maybe out front. Okay. Did you guys get that?
Yeah, we did, actually.
Okay.
Garden, all right, out front. So
yeah. I thought I had a red light turning on the outside of the bedroom door, but, you know.
Should have put a flower out.
Put a flower or a tie on.
That's right. That's right. Tie on the doorknob. Yeah. It would be something different. I don't know if you guys realize that, but okay.
Yes,
so,
it would be, we realized it would be something. Yeah, we realized.
It's all good.
Yeah, right.
Yes, the red light. And we're just in the same way they were assuming that Robert was in your room. you know, we're assuming that, yeah.
Exactly. And was that, by Tim Matheson and Tom Hulce, was that
Animal House?
Animal House. You know what? Yeah. I've officially become senile.
It's okay.
I could not remember the name.
It's okay because being on the greatest 80s podcast of all time with two of the dictionaries of the IMDb's of the podcast world, I guess.
Yes, we pride ourselves on knowing, you know, the most random shit that no one will ever need to know, and we just know it. Yeah.
Like Brock and Davis.
Like Brock and Davis.
Like Brock and Davis, that's right.
You know, speaking of that band, I mean, we have a whole... I feel ashamed saying this now. We love the band, too. And more specific...
We're not going to Denny's, I'm telling you right now.
Damn it.
I just want the flowers, man. No, just more specifically, that song that was playing at the prom...
Hard Way.
The Hard Way was very hard to track down because they never released the version that was in the movie to the public. So, but it's a good song. But damn that band. No damn that band.
Damn
taking
that,
all the ladies.
That Mr.
I hate
wannabe
that
band.
Song now, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, here's my question, because when I watched the movie, the band seems really old. Like, they seem so much older than everyone else. So was that the case? I mean, were these ladies like, you know, these guys, they seem like they're late 30s, early 40s. Maybe that's just how they looked.
I never really got close enough to them to get a good look.
You didn't get close enough to smell their breath?
Yeah, no, I couldn't really distinguish them. It was low light. You know, it was hard for me to tell.
You know, low light. Well, it's because you know, Terry's best friend Denise is like pining after the band member. She's like, I'm going to go hang out with the band member. Like, you're in high school, and he's not. So this isn't.
But he's 40.
Yeah, he's 40, right. And you're in high school. So this is just kind of gross.
Kind of a thing, though.
Yeah. It is a thing. Yeah. But we're, you know,
different
times.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
That's true. Different times. That's true. Speaking of different times, Soul Man. No, I'm kidding.
That is a perfect segue. Right. That is a perfect.
Wait a second. There might be something I don't talk about.
Next. No.
Law school.
Yeah! Woo! Yeah!
Tuition and fees. $10,493.
Harvard Law School. This is a big day for all of us. That's why I've decided to let you pay your own way.
Estimated annual living expenses.
You ever applied for a loan before?
$7,500.
Mr. Watson, you don't pay your bills. Get out.
Total for 3 years of law school.
Wait a second, look at this. Full tuition for the most qualified applicant.
Most qualified black applicant.
$53,979. Don't you think you're overreacting? No.
Congratulations, Mr. Watson.
Thank you, sir. I'll do my best.
Some people would do anything to get into Harvard.
It's gonna be great! These are the 80s, man! It's the Cosby decade!
For Mark Watson, all it took was a little soul.
I'd like you to meet my good friend, Kareem Abdul-Ali.
We got Washington here on the coin toss, so he'll take Leon.
That's Watson.
Right. Sorry, Marcus.
Yeah, there may be a problem here. Your roommate was a,
what?
A black Negro.
A black Negro?
You know, there's something really strange about you, and I don't know what it is.
Oh, God, is she beautiful? You gotta believe me.
You must have learned a great deal more than you bargained for.
Tell her I'm white.
Don't tell her you're white!
What's going on?
Can we blame him for the color of his skin?
Mom, Dad, I'm black.
What?
No, you're crazy.
Mark Watson.
Come on now!
From the producer of Risky Business, Soul Man. He didn't give up, he got down.
Not on. You really hate the Beach Boys now?
No, I come on, hit me.
Well, here's the thing. That film it's very controversial, you know, in today's kind of realm. Like, obviously your character is not the one charged with any sort of
right. Your character is great. You're the best part of the movie. And I mean,
don't even have time to argue that point, but
yeah,
go on.
No. No, it's just one of those movies that, you know, we look at it now, we're like, obviously that could never be made today. You know,
that's correct.
It came out in 86, in 86.
Yep.
And, you know, and at the time, I think everybody was just like, well, this is just like a fun, you know, I think its intention was, it seemed like a well-intentioned movie. It was trying to bring a little bit of awareness to the, you know, to the African-American difficulties at that time in the 80s. But when you really, you know, when you really look at it, you're like, oh, well, this is incredibly offensive. when you look at it now, I should say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I probably should watch it again. I don't think, you know, I saw it at the screening. I had an incredibly good time. I had a great time working on it. And I know that, in an absolute sense, the intention of the movie, of the writers, Carol Black and Neil Marlins, and, you know, the producers, was to, make an 80s movie, an 80s comedy, that took on the issue of white liberal racism, and, you know, with a desire to make people laugh and rethink their, you know, rethink this notion that we were living in a colorblind America because the Cosby Show was the biggest show on television, and you know, and there were, you know, sports and entertainment figures that were, you know, hugely successful, that it didn't mean that racism was over in America. So we didn't think we were making Black Like Me, but we thought we were making a comedy that actually was, you know, that had something righteous to say. And I think it kind of caught everyone by surprise that, I mean, some people really embraced it. And certainly a popular movie for the time. But, you know, She's Gotta Have It came out, you know, the same weekend. And,
oh, wow.
And Spike Lee just savaged the movie and Ray Don Chong for being in it. You know, that's a shame. You know, the crazy thing is I you know, several months ago, I really liked Samantha Bee.
Yeah, she's great.
And it was probably a year ago, actually. She was doing something on her show about systemic racism, and then used a clip from Soul Man and made the statement, "Hey, sure, things are getting a little better. I mean, in the 80s, everybody was super happy making an anti-affirmative action comedy," which was like, it couldn't be farther from the truth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I actually think you kind of, yes, the movie would not be made today, but, and I think if you really look at the movie, the objects of ridicule are, not just racist whites, but white people who think they have no racism at all.
Yeah, that's a good, really good point.
Yeah.
But more importantly, I did get to work with Leslie Nielsen.
I mean, come on. Well, that speaks a lot to your career. You've worked with so many equally, and I say equally because we held you in the same regard. Yeah, see, your phone agrees with us. Equally talented performers, and including Leslie Nielsen and obviously James Earl Jones. You've done so. Your body of work is so extensive, specifically in the 80s and going into the 90s. And I think, you know, when we look at your movies from Soul Man to, you know, Tequila Sunrise and The Experts, which I really want to talk about, by the way, and down Coupe de Ville and et cetera, you've been surrounded by so many talented people, which obviously elevates the quality of the film that you're in, but you stand out. Like Justin said, you're the best part of Soul Man. I would say that you're the best part of many of the films you've been in.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I mean, I think Soul Man, yeah, I think there's also a piece of Soul Man too. Go watch the movie first before you comment on it. Just don't look at the poster, like as often a lot of people do.
Right, because the tagline, right, is in order to get in, he had to get down. And you're like, oh. No. Like, and that's why.
Believe me.
That really doesn't help its cause at all.
No.
I'm not saying there wasn't much that was egregious about a lot of things surrounding the movie, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think anybody was particularly happy with Tommy's makeup.
No, but I think watching the film is a whole different story than just reading that tagline or looking at the poster. A comedy with heart and soul.
In case anybody listening is confused, you know, Soul Man is a movie in which C. Thomas Howell takes tanning pills to become black in order to get a scholarship into Harvard Law School.
To qualify for the only scholarship that just happens to be set aside for an African-American student.
Yes, that is a good...
In the process, denies the person who should have received it, who's played by Ray Don Chong.
Yes.
context. And it's a bad thing that he does. We're not saying it's a good thing.
Right.
No, of course not.
No.
Yeah.
But it's a good point that you're making too about how our lens at that time was vastly different. And this idea that, we got the Cosby Show on TV, and I'm a big fan of O.J. Simpson. He's a great football player and great commentator, you know, and that doesn't qualifies me as being, you know, not racist or whatever.
Right. Right. But when you look at it as a primarily white filmmaking team, you know, like you look at that now, you're like, okay, well, that's not the best, you know, as far as telling an accurate story.
But like you said, you got to work with Leslie Nielsen, who... Right. Come on.
Legendary.
So. Do you know that he would constantly carry a sort of hand-operated whoopee cushion with him at virtually all times?
No.
No. Please indulge.
When he was meeting people, they'd go, oh, hi, can we take your picture? And he'd go, certainly. What's your name? I'm Bob. Oh, geez, that's crazy. And he'd say, I'm Leslie Nielsen. But he wouldn't see where it was coming from. And we were staying in this hotel, and like every time we'd get in the elevator with him, as soon as like strangers would get in the elevator car, he would start working his
fantastic.
Little fart bag. It was amazing.
Bless him.
Oh,
yeah. The ones where you don't know where they're coming from. Those are the best ones where it's just like, because you're questioning what you've heard. Like, okay.
That's right.
I heard it.
It was amazing.
That is awesome. I think nowadays, farting is more acceptable in public than coughing. So, you know,
for sure.
I know we want to make sure we cover other bases too. I have to say, in full disclosure, I rewatched The Experts last night for the first time in probably 10 years, maybe. And I would love to talk a little bit about that if you're up for it.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, I know that film was, it's, you know, got Bill Travolta as the lead, and rightfully so. And it's got some hiccups here and there, but again, you are the show stealer in that film, specifically for your awesome hair, which is like a mulleted kind of, and your wardrobe, which I think would go over really well nowadays.
Yeah. What was the, I had, when I went to audition, I dressed all in black, because it starts out with the guys, you know, they're in this sort of, you know, working at a nightclub in New York.
Yeah.
And so
was
all
that
black,
New York, by
black
the way?
Hat. What's that?
Was that New York, by the way?
Oh, no. That was like, you know, Toronto or something. That,
okay. I just want to clarify.
Yeah. I don't think we set foot in the United States while we're shooting that.
Okay.
And then when I got hired, the costume designer called me and said, "Hey, so listen, everybody really liked what you wore for the audition. So we're going to give, so that's what John's going to wear."
Of course, yeah.
With the pants
tucked into the cowboy boots, by the way.
Right. Oh my God.
Yeah. I had skipped that, actually.
good call.
And, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with it, but
no,
it just wasn't my thing.
Yeah, and, personal choice.
And then they said, "Well, what do you want? Hey, what do you think your guy, Wendell, I think was my name, should look like?" And so I called a friend of mine who was the stylist on Soul Man, Sharon Simoner. She said, "So if it's against black, it should probably just be like a bunch of mixed matched colors and patterns." So I said, "Okay." Right. And I brought that to the costume designer, and they came up with the wardrobe on that. All right, you know, fine, sure. Great.
was the bandana around your neck? Was that your choice, or?
I don't recall it being my choice, and if it was, it was a different time.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Look, that movie. So that movie opens with some. We love neon, and obviously we're huge fans of the '80s, and like, so the opening credits is like blue neon and pink neon, and it's just so, and it has that vibe. You made that movie. I know the film was shelved for a couple of years, and so it was probably made in like 86 or 87. And then Dave Thomas directed it, right?
Yes. Dave from SCTV.
Yeah.
Awesome. Do you ever see him do the yelling, like Scotsman on SCTV?
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. That was pretty much how he directed the movie.
Oh, gosh.
he was great. I think it was like maybe 3 days into shooting the film. He called me after the third day and said, "Hey, just wanted to ask you, it's Paramount, right?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Paramount. It's the reason you did the movie is because it's a big Paramount movie." And I said, "Well, I mean that was like part of it, sure." And he said, "Because it wasn't me. You know, I don't have any directing credibility, and certainly not the script. So, but like, what drew you to this? Like, what made you say yes?" And I was like, "Well, Dave, I think it was just a big opportunity." And he went, "Yeah, okay, me too."
Oh, that's funny.
And you know, the original idea that the spec script that had been submitted, it was still called The Experts, but and it was about a town in Russia that had been, you know, a mock American town, where you know, KGB agents would be trained for deep cover work in the U.S.
Yeah,
and in the original script, they had imported some stuff from New York, and with it, cockroaches. So they'd never had these kind of cockroaches, so they kidnapped two guys who were exterminators.
Oh.
And which has got, it's a little edgier, don't you think?
Yeah.
And so they think they're in another American city and slowly discover that they're, you know, somewhere in the Soviet Union.
It's darker. It's definitely darker.
It is darker. But you know, along the way, you know, there's always somebody who's like, now hold on a second. Mm. What if instead of exterminators, they're nightclub employees? You know, like, oh, I can see it. I can see it now.
Yeah.
Wow. And, but you know, the thing that really did in the movie, it was, you know, perestroika. And you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union, which, I mean, on my long list of resentments against Russia at the moment, that's still pretty high up there.
Yeah.
I thought the experts was going to do something other than a week in Texas and Oklahoma.
Yeah, because it has many things going for it, in my opinion. I think it looks like you and John had a really fun time, kind of pairing off each other, and he was at such a great, like, this was right before he started kind of making his quote unquote comeback as a big screen actor, you know. And
I was really hoping this would have been the thing that had been would have been the comeback. But no, it had to wait, I guess.
To your point about nightclub employees, I mean, how much of that do you think is related to, like, well, we need Travolta to dance, and a dancing exterminator is harder to sell? Or maybe not at all.
It's a good point.
You know, that sounds as good an explanation as any I've heard.
Well, I was going to say your dance moves are on par with his dance moves.
Yeah.
You know. Bravo.
I don't really recall dancing in the movie, but
you did in the
I'll take that.
When that the weird cantina club gets remade as your ooh-ooh-ah, I think it's called ooh-ooh-la.
Ooh-ooh-ah.
I think it's called ooh-ooh-ah. Yeah. Anyways, and you're having like the welcoming committee, and they're all having their buffet plates in the nightclub. And at one point, you were dancing. No, sorry. It's when Back of the USSR is being played. The cover version, by the way, by Jack Mack and the Heart Attack. Local LA band. Anyways, you're getting down with Travolta. It's one of the many montage scenes in that movie. There's some great montage scenes in it.
Yeah.
So that was one of them.
And that's the movie where he met Kelly Preston, right?
Yeah.
I believe that's...
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Who's a wonderful actor, and rest in peace, obviously.
And and sadly missed. She was a very nice person. I really have had, I don't think I've had any contact with them since shortly after that movie came out. But I have nothing but good memories about both of them.
Well, just know that it has a warm place in our hearts as well, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was going to say,
okay.
I was going to say too, you know, it wasn't that, it didn't follow up right after that film, but a few years later, you made a movie called Coupe de Ville.
Yeah.
Written by Mike Binder, who at the time it was like kind of like a trilogy. He did Crossing the Bridge, Coupe de Ville. I think that came out timeline wise, correct? And then Indian Summer. Right. Indian Summer came out after that. And I grew up in Michigan, from Michigan originally. So I had a fondness for Coupe de Ville. What a great road trip. Hey, actually, today's Daniel Stern's birthday. So
is it?
Yes, it is.
That's awesome.
That's right.
But it looks like you guys had an equally fun time making that movie.
We did. It was, I mean, first of all, I mean, it was as a road trip, we shot all over the place. You know, we were in Georgia, we were in Florida, we were in South Carolina, we were in North Carolina. It was a great experience. And, I became friends with Patrick and Daniel and,
Patrick Dempsey.
That's right. I loved working with Daniel and less so with Patrick, because he was deeply, deeply committed to being the unbelievably annoying younger brother.
Uh-huh.
Which he plays really well.
He was. And there were times in the car when Daniel was driving and Patrick was needling him and I was in the middle having to like break them up so that like Daniel didn't crash the car.
Right.
I got to work with Annabeth Gish,
mm-hmm. Alan Arkin,
and of course Alan Arkin.
Yeah.
That was the I was able to do Mother Night with him a few years later.
Fantastic.
And I've done theater with both his sons Matthew and Adam, who's one of my closest friends. Alan is absolutely a hero of mine from my first inklings of ever wanting to be an actor.
I saw that movie opening day when it came out.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And because, again, I was such a huge fan of Mike Binder's work. And I was like, oh, wait, another Michigan movie? You know, because at the time I hadn't really seen I moved to California, but I still had a lot of fondness for anything from my home. Town grew up right outside Detroit, right. So I could relate. And I don't know, I loved it. And yeah, Annabeth Gish at the time, like, I mean, she's a phenomenal actor, but she was top of her game at that point. Just a fun road trip. I love a good road trip movie.
Well, and it's also, I mean, it's a very disarming movie. Zach had been telling me about this movie, and I was like, Coupe de Ville. And then the second I started rewatching it, I was like, oh, I've totally seen this and it's amazing. But it's a movie that it's a relationship movie about three brothers who don't get along and kind of their journey from Detroit to Florida, driving this car down to their father as a present for their mother. And it's
Miami.
But what got me is the fact that like, it was kind of like I was totally engrossed in the movie and no pun intended. And but just watching the relationship develop, you know, and reconnect with the brothers, like really got me, like hit me in the feels. I was like, oh, and I did not expect it at all. Especially at the end of it. It's just very, it was surprisingly powerful. It was surprising.
Yeah. Mike's a wonderful writer.
Yeah.
I feel like even while we were shooting it, by the way, Joe Roth, I think, is a great director, and I wish that he had directed more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not that he won't, but you know, he very quickly became, you know, the movie actually has kind of the business side of the movie has sort of an interesting tale, because Joe Roth was running a company called Morgan Creek, mm-hmm. At the time. And
I didn't know he was running that company.
Yeah. And so I think he had like a 10 picture deal with Universal. They had done Young Guns and something else, and Coupe de Ville was one of those movies. And while we were shooting Coupe de Ville, Joe Roth was being offered the job as the you know president of production for 20th Century Fox.
Oh wow!
And he ultimately decided to take it, and so you know once the movie ended, once we you know finished production on the film, and I guess he finished cutting it, he was now the you know the chief executive at Fox, and the people at Universal were pissed off at him.
Yeah,
because they'd had a 10-picture deal with Morgan Creek, but they had it with him, and he went from being their supplier to their competitor. And so a decision was made, I think, to kind of punish him to fulfill the minimum obligation for the release of Coupe de Ville, which was to release it for 7 days and pull it.
Oh my God.
And so my understanding is Joe tried to buy the negative and have for 20th Century Fox to release, but Universal made the price so high that Joe couldn't, as one of the first things he did at 20th Century Fox was overpay for his own movie.
What a story, man.
Yeah. So
that's so frustrating.
and that's why it's sort of like, it was out for a second, and then it went away, and then it was, you know, turned up on cable, but couldn't get a, you know, a VCR or a DVD of it for a long time. I don't even know if there are DVDs of it now.
It's available now. Yeah, no. There's like a it's kind of a print-on-demand type thing that, that Universal does now.
Okay.
But well, it's on, and it's also on HBO Max. Which is great.
Oh, really? Yep. Oh, good. I hadn't realized.
Because it definitely should be revisited.
Yep.
Obviously, if it's pulling up the feels and Dustin,
it is. I mean, it's not like it's some rare, you know.
No, I get him to cry all the time. Actually,
I mean, I cry. I mean, I don't cry. I mean, I, you know,
don't cry.
Sorry, right? Yeah. Let it turn to something else.
No, but that story, that's heartbreaking because you know this is the other side aspect that people don't necessarily understand is there is many sides to a film being made.
Politics, baby.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Sure. Well, you know, so my obsession recently, I've just watched this French spy drama called The Bureau.
Okay.
Have you seen this at all?
No. Is it? Where do you watch that?
I watched it on, it's on Sundance Now that I got to via Amazon Prime Video.
Okay.
And they're streaming 5 seasons of this show, and they're like 10 episode seasons.
Okay.
And it's about what goes on at this French intelligence agency where the agents train to go into the field undercover and develop human intelligence contacts and try to persuade people to work for French intelligence. And I don't know in what way, but evidently it's loosely based on some true stories. And it's, I'm telling you, it's a great show. I've just finished it. And the unifying idea of the 5 seasons of this show is that these kind of world-shaking events have their, you know, their genesis in personal relationships and, you know, and resentments or, you know, people who love each other being separated, and then the effort to like reunite people has earth-shaking implications.
Interesting.
You know, kind of like the butterfly effect.
Yeah.
Yep.
And, you know, and the movie industry certainly is not immune to, you know, personal grievances or, you know, affecting the release of a movie.
Totally.
Yeah. You know, yeah, good times.
Yeah.
So that's going to do it now.
And we're out of time.
No.
All right.
But you know,
mask up, everybody.
Yeah, right.
Should be over in a few short years.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, my son said that to me actually the other day. He said, when are we going to be able to go back to school? You know, because he really wants to be in person with his teacher, and rightfully so. I said, look, bud, you know, I don't know, but, you know, we'll just take each day as it comes. I think that's all we're doing now is taking one day at a time. I said, we're all living the Alcoholics Anonymous lifestyle. It's like, wake up, see what's going on.
Move. That's right.
You had to explain the Alcoholics Anonymous lifestyle.
Right? I got him a chip. No, I'm kidding. No, just kidding. No, but no, yeah. to go back to your point, it's like, unfortunately, yeah, the politics of many of these films that we love, The Experts included, it's one of those stories where it's like, well, this got shelved for a couple of years, or this is why this didn't get happen, or this is why this film didn't make as much money as it did, or yada, yada, yada. But at the core, at the end of the day, I can tell you that we have so much love for your body of work. And as we've said throughout this entire interview.
Yeah, the movies still reach, you know, they still reach the audience.
And I think they're reaching a new audience.
The intended audience and then the new audience. And that's what we're trying to do on this show, is like revisit a lot of these things that were our favorites and spread the love.
Yeah, there's enough.
I'm glad you guys are doing this because, you know, I love working, I love acting, and I had a great time on, you know, doing these flicks. And
yeah, we didn't even get a chance to talk about House 2, but you know, actually I talked to Jonathan Stark a little while back, and he talked about how you guys you know, every now and then you go on eBay to find the lost promo items that they put out.
Yeah, well, yeah, we like text each other when we find like a cat or puppy somewhere.
Yeah, so cool. I love that. That's
awesome.
You know, or like a lobby stand or something. I've found like an Italian poster for the movie that's on sale, but it's like, you know, the bidding's at several hundred dollars, and I'm just watching it right now.
That's gonna be flattering.
Maybe it comes down.
Oh my god.
Maybe make it a birthday present for John.
Well, see, that's what. Oh, and then there you go. I think your phone just said yes. You need to do that. I was just going to say too. That's something that I love hearing is when you love your movie so much, because sometimes we'll talk to actors and they're like, oh, I don't watch my work. No,
yep.
And that's much respect. It's all good.
Mind.
Yeah, but I love that you're like, yeah, I want to talk about this movie. I want to talk about House 2, or I want to talk about the cat or puppies, and you know. And the fact that you still have this photo from Just One of the Guys, which we can't wait to see, by the way, it's going to be amazing. I just think that's so wonderful, and it's so hopeful. And then, like Dustin said, that's the whole point of our show, is to uplift and at least bring a little bit of joy for an hour, 90 minutes or whatever. Forget about your worries for a little bit and take this trip down memory lane in a positive way. And, gosh, it is just really fantastic to hear the stories behind some of the movies we loved. And my hope and my intention is that down the road, when everything, whether it's 2 years or who knows, doing something in person and being able to see you and, you know, shake your hand, well, give you an elbow bump, I guess. Just to say thank you for the hours of joy that you've given us over the years.
Oh, well, thanks a lot. That gives me all the feels for sure. Thank you. Somebody posted on Twitter this little video of a ancient woman getting off a plane in Israel and meeting her. She's like a Holocaust survivor meeting her her kids, but her like children or grandchildren and great grandchildren, and they had like a, you know, looked like a 10x10 sheet of plastic set up. And they'd sort of like hug with the plastic sheet between them. It just looked like great and terrible.
Yeah, right. It reminds me of it going back to Leslie Nielsen.
The body condoms.
The body condoms.
I was totally thinking that too.
Exactly. Well, you know.
Oh, gosh.
An idea whose time has come.
Right. Oh, Ari, thank you again for being on our show. It's really an honor.
Really appreciate it.
Really my pleasure, guys. And honored. Honored that you gave me a call.
All right, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it.
Don't forget to subscribe and give us a 4... Is it 5-star rating?
Don't forget to subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes. If you listen to us on Spotify, that's great too. And you can find us on the internet. Don't forget to check out our website at $2LateFee.com and follow us on Instagram and Facebook at $2LateFeePodcast. We'll see you next time.
We did it.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.